All right, I'm gonna go ahead and start. I appreciate you guys coming out for last session, first day. Exciting day, lots of exciting things going on. So we're gonna talk a bunch about storage today. My name is Zach Rosenfield. I work as a program manager on the storage team in SharePoint. I've been on the SharePoint team for about 8 years, working in the back-end infrastructure side of things. So first thing I have to clarify is this change from SkyDrive Pro to OneDrive for Business, it's new for me. I just want to caveat, I might say SkyDrive Pro, I might say I can say anything from OneDrive Pro, anything like that. I'm really trying to say OneDrive for Business. I'll try to watch myself. But we have four main topics we're going to hit on. First is we're going to talk about the cost drivers for running a large-scale service, something like a OneDrive for Business, either on-prem or online. We're going to talk about that in the context of Microsoft's own tenant. So we're going to dig in on sort of what does the Microsoft tenant look like. It's a pretty large business. How do we consume it? What would be the cost involved in running OneDrive for Business offering for us, either on-prem or online? We'll hit on how SharePoint Online handles a lot of the challenges that will come up in talking about running something at that scale. And then finally, we'll hit on some tips for running OneDrive for Business for yourself. So let's dig in. There's sort of four key cost drivers that really come in when you're trying to run something of this size and scale. So the behaviors of something like OneDrive for Business, it has a very organic growth element. And so you actually end up running into sort of these four main elements. First off is file count and size. Understanding how many files you'll have, how big they'll be, the frequency at which they will come into the service has a big impact on how big your footprint actually needs to be. The file sync overhead, we'll hit on this a bit, sort of getting those files into the service, synchronizing them with the devices, and it definitely with the increase of the number of devices per individual, the overhead actually just increases. Third, obviously, you have to store those files. And as you increase your availability, as you want to offer a better reliability story for your users, this will continue to have an impact on how much it costs to run your service. And then finally is growth management. We'll talk a bit about the OneDrive for Business, how the growth patterns for that look. I don't know if any of you are running OneDrive for Business on-prem today, or SkyDrive Pro as the 2013 product, but you can actually have some pretty amazing growth patterns, and we'll just kind of go through some examples of that. So the first place to start with is we got to talk about that file count and size. And as I said, we're going to use Microsoft's own personal tenant as an example. Now, we run Microsoft's tenant as part of the SharePoint Online offering. It's part of our multi-tenant service. So these are numbers that represent that tenant, but it's within that greater set of overall size that we're able to run this tenancy. But these numbers would be the same if we ran this offering on-prem. So we've been running OneDrive for Business. It was fully launched to the enterprise right around the same time we got SharePoint Online running 2013 in the cloud. So it's been about a year. And in that year, just in OneDrive for Business, we have 60 terabytes of user-created data in OneDrive for Business. It's currently growing at about 150,000 files per day, average size around 2 megabytes. The interesting thing here is that we at Microsoft have 150,000 users who have created a OneDrive for Business site. So this means they use the Office client or they went to the OneDrive for Business site often to share a file. You know, it's got a great sort of external sharing story. So you get a couple of users, or actually a lot of users, 150,000 users in total, who have at least gone there once and done something. But 40,000 users have at least one or more devices connected to synchronize their OneDrive for Business to their personal or corporate devices. And those 40,000 users correspond to 92% of that storage growth. So when it comes to who is responsible for a majority of that organic growth that we see on a day-to-day basis, it actually really comes down to these synchronizing users. And those are basically the users who are creating the cost to the system, and the rest just sort of fit in the cracks of the leftover resources. The other element here is you really have to understand your organization. OneDrive for Business at Microsoft, you see our file count breakouts here. We are a heavy office using company. Probably not a surprise, we build those products, but between 3 and 4 million Excel, Word, PowerPoint files in our service, and those are a majority of how we grow. Obviously, if the company in question is big on video files or uses a lot of images or creates giant AutoCAD files, you're gonna have a very different set of characteristics. So when you're dealing with a single tenancy, you have to be prepared for what your organization will actually do with the system versus what we can do in SharePoint Online, where we get to use the large number of tenancies and kind of average things out. So the challenges can be a little bit different, and it's just important you understand your organization going in. Second element was sync. So what do I mean by sync? Well, there's two parts to the sync client. The sync client is this OneDrive for Business client, but it also uses the Office document cache, which if you use Word, Excel, PowerPoint, you talk to SharePoint, that's the actual code that's going to do the file save, file open. It kind of sits in your taskbar. You'll see it once in a while. And so when you set up a new device to synchronize with SharePoint, what you actually get is the OneDrive for client business, OneDrive for business client, is actually reaching out to SharePoint and saying, hey, give me a list of all the files that I need to sync. SharePoint will return the list, and the client will actually reconcile which files it already has, which files it needs to go download. And in the case where it needs to go download something, it will send another request through the Office document cache for that file. And SharePoint will return that file through the front ends in pieces, up to 3.5 megs each. It's going to chunk those documents into smaller pieces, up to 3.5 megs, and it will serially download that document. So one piece at a time for that document. And the client will do up to 5 documents in parallel. So when you think about the amount of load that the clients can provide, per device, a user can incur 5 simultaneous connections, and each of those connections can download a document of any size, but it'll be constantly downloading these smaller chunks throughout. So, what does that mean for us? Well, the Microsoft tenant requires 50 cores to be able to handle the peak load of our 40,000 synchronizing users. So 50 cores. And those 50 cores end up doing not just the transfer of files in and out, but is also doing some of the background operations like antivirus scanning and any sort of background operation related to those files as they come into the service or get downloaded back out. You know, you have people with multiple devices, often a document comes in and has to go back out pretty quickly. But we find that this actually fits in a linear pattern throughout the service. And so what we end up seeing is this relationship, and this is a rough number, but roughly 800 synchronizing users consume 1 core at their peak. And we see that at businesses of all sizes. So you see here, in terms of the number of users, as the number of users goes up, the number of cores linearly increases with them. And so for Microsoft, when we get all 150,000 of our employees onto the sync client, we're going to need about 200 cores to be able to handle that peak. I also throw this out here just because I like to remind folks, if you are familiar with the PLA, our architecture guidance, generally we recommend taking these heavy background operations where a user is not actively waiting on whatever that operation is. Here it's a file sync. Put that traffic on machines that is not the same as those actually serving web pages or anything where users are waiting for something to render. Just general guidance. So the third element is storage. And I won't spend too much time going through all the elements of storage, but I just sort of have a meta point here, which is providing a no downtime service, high availability for storage, ultimately ends up costing a lot. This is sort of a typical, very highly available SharePoint architecture. I put a file on disk, and I end up getting a second copy because of RAID, and then I mirror that, I get 4 copies. I probably need to store some logs. I'm going to have backups, both full and partials. I'm going to have a lot of copies of every document in my service, and if I'm providing disaster recovery, I'm going to duplicate that entire thing in a secondary data center. And when you think about the scale of something like a OneDrive for Business for any company that's of any significant scale, you're talking about a lot of machines. And once you have a lot of machines, you have to really think about all of the operational costs that you're going to incur. How do you patch those machines? How do you provide security for those machines? How do you monitor those machines? Do you buy extra machines for when you're patching? Or do you actually have moments of downtime? All of those questions have to be worked through, have to go in advance, and it's just a very real cost. And we'll dig in on sort of storage options a little bit down the road. The other element here is managing growth. The OneDrive for Business usage patterns that we see at most companies is very, very fast. So you see here, these are the terabytes per day that we see in SharePoint Online in team sites and in OneDrive. Now, team sites started out way ahead of everything else, right? It's an established business. It's been around for a long time. But it's still growing at a nice rate. But OneDrive growth is actually growing not just exponentially, but you know, Jeff mentioned that hockey stick feel. It's really starting to accelerate up the hockey stick. This is actually about 3 weeks old, and we're beating these projections in the last month. So things are just continuing to go faster and faster and faster. We have the benefit in SharePoint Online of being able to spread those spikes out across all the different tenancies. So we have new folks, we have folks who've been around for a long time, and so we're able to share that cost. But at an individual tenant level, it can be pretty drastically different. So I want to show an example. This is a real tenant. I took these snapshots just last week, I think on Tuesday. This is a real tenant. It's been growing. And back in December, end of the year, it had about 200 to 300 users coming in per day. And then they launched, clearly went live, their pilot was over, and we saw this nice gradual increase of users day over day. So really a nice sort of normal onboarding pattern. And this is very easy to manage, very easy to deal with. Over that exact same time window, we had another tenant who started with about 200 users back in December. And then on Monday, jumped to 12,000, and on Tuesday hit 37,000, and they've actually just sort of stayed right around there. They launched the entire organization on one day. And so being able to predict how folks will use the system, how many of those folks will set up sync on those first few days, being able to handle these different growth patterns, it can be quite a challenge. So generally, we like to say that single tenants, sort of the growth pattern of a single tenant, is just too spiky for us to really predict how it's going to be. As a result, in SharePoint Online, we have to do a lot of database splits. We basically take a database that is now full, and we end up having to chop it in half. We have to maintain a database size, and so we're constantly doing these operations. And at the same time, our servers are getting full. We're growing super fast, and so we're always having to take databases and move them to new servers. So these are constantly happening throughout the service. But it's a big challenge for us, because these incur read-only downtime windows. If any of you are using Office 365, you may have gotten a DB maintenance window email. Just know it pains me every time we send one of those things. So we're going to talk about what we're going to do about those things in a little bit, but these are real challenges that you will face on-prem today. And then finally, database level projections. We've just found that it's impossible to predict who your heavy users will be, who your inactive users will be. So in general, we recommend staying away from any sort of pre-provisioning, any sort of activity where you try to decide upfront who's going to be where they should be. We find that we are horribly inaccurate at it. It's very, very hard. It's very unpredictable. It's just too small of a scale unit. The other element about pre-provisioning that I like to call out is, as an administrator, if you pre-provision, you end up managing those resources. And over time, if you pre-provision a lot of elements, they really do consume resources. You'll have to upgrade them. You'll have to manage them. And in some cases, they consume resources you may not think about. The search index, for example, every time you create a blank OneDrive for Business site, creates about 20 to 30 items in the search index. And if you have 100,000 users, you're actually consuming quite a bit of space in your search index. And now you're scaling out your search index to be able to handle all of these things for users who may or may not really be using the service. So that was all complicated and hard and sort of scary. So what are we doing in SharePoint Online? Well, I'm going to start where we left off and talk about onboarding. So I said don't pre-provision, which means you have to onboard live. You have to onboard as customers show up, as users show up. So we ended 2013, we shipped the product, and what we found in the lab is that a blank OneDrive for Business site took about 30 seconds to create. And so you look at that and you say, hey, if it takes 30 seconds per ContentDB, I can do about 2,800 per day, and you know that's about 120 per hour, 1,000 during work hours. But in reality, most of your users show up at the same time of the day. You're going to launch at a single time, single moment in time of the day. And so as a result, you don't actually get the throughput that you really want. And we see this in SharePoint Online. And I like that I can use SharePoint Online to really show you some numbers. But we're normally under a minute in SharePoint Online. But there are times when you know a giant university decides to launch SharePoint Online or major companies show up and start provisioning in mass, that things really do get quite a bit longer, and we really want to work on that. So what we found when we dig in is that SharePoint features are sort of the long pole. So what happens when you create a site collection is, in the end, you just get a bunch of fields in a database. But in order to get there, we one at a time had to wake up some code. We had to reason over what language is this, what template is this, what features are enabled for you. And in the end, we dynamically created those rows in the database that if we had considered up front, we would have realized every user who provisions that site in that language, they all look exactly the same. So what we built is this concept of fast site provisioning. We're rolling the first wave of it now, and it's going to take us multiple waves to really get this thing finalized. The exciting thing about the service, and you'll see this throughout some of the functionality we're building, is we get an opportunity to perfect that technology now. We can roll it out before it's 100% completed. We can modify. We can get feedback from customers before we really get that fully packaged feature. Think of it as sort of now we get to ship the SP1s instead of having to ship that first release and get the feedback after it had already been sent. So this first release, what we're doing now is we take those site masters, basically that initial definition per template, per language, and we can copy them in raw SQL. So much faster. I don't have to go through and iterate over all these complex decisions. I'm just doing a raw SQL copy of that data. Now, not all features support this yet, but we're rolling out the first wave of this into SharePoint Online. And so what you see on this chart on the bottom, and this is real data from production, is this first wave, which we've rolled out. We get about 50,000 sites a day created using this new tech. The red bubble shows you where the old 2013 provisioning, where a majority of users were in terms of time. So a majority of users were right in that 30-second range, but there's this pretty long tail of users out there. The blue represents the new fast site provisioning, and not only has it improved the speed at which a majority of sites get created, but the bubble's actually bigger. More users now get that faster experience. And as we improve this, we think that once we get the rest of the features out there, we've done some initial data gathering exercises, we think we can improve another 75%. So pretty massive improvement in terms of the provisioning rates, enabling us to really move to everything coming online as the users show up. So second element of managing capacity, managing your storage costs, we really believe in this concept of predictive capacity. At a high level, what I want to say is that it's very, very challenging once you start talking about hundreds of servers to try and manage each resource individually. So trying to think about how much CPU do I need, how much RAM do I need, how much storage do I need, all these different resources start to add up and add a lot of complexity to your ability to comprehend how much you really need to go buy. So what we believe in SharePoint Online is this idea of using one element as an indicator of growth. We've chosen storage. We think it's very easy to comprehend. It grows at a very predictable rate, and it's very easy to measure to see at what your storage usage is across the service. And we model everything off of that one element. So I'll show you in a second sort of one of our models. But everything is based off of storage. And then we build a consistent ratio of other resources to that. So we have a preset amount of RAM, of CPU, of other elements that we purchase for every terabyte of storage that we put into the service. And we might end up buffering those other elements a little bit, but we end up saving so much in terms of time, in terms of resources, in the management overhead, that we think it's significantly easier to track things sort of at a single resource level. The other elements we do is we do proactive growth modeling, so we project out into the future. I'll show you that. And then finally, we also do this, and this really only works at scale. You have to have a lot of environments, but we believe in just-in-time allocation of hardware. So we buy hardware based on our model for a particular environment. Our model says this environment's going to need that storage. But we don't actually allocate hardware until it's actually needed. So we run all of our environments at this goal state that we feel is a good amount of capacity utilization, but don't actually, you know, ever let it get too close to being full, but we also don't ever want it to be completely empty. So I'm going to show you what I mean. This is an actual model from one of our environments. I believe this is an environment in the US. And what you're looking at here is the day-by-day terabytes being added into the service in this environment, and that's that blue line at the bottom. So that is just the actual growth of that environment day-by-day. We take that growth rate and we project it out into the future. So we take the last 6 months of behavior and we project it out 6 months, and that's our standard projection. That's that dotted blue line. That shows you, hey, if users just keep doing what they're doing, this is how much they will consume. But we also want to make sure we cover ourselves, make sure that we, you know, have hedged a little bit. And so what we've done is we've analyzed sort of what is an aggressive usage pattern for companies of this size, for users of this size, what's an aggressive pattern, and that's that purple line. And it gives us a range, and it sort of says, hey, if users just keep doing what they're doing, they're going to be down at the bottom. If users start getting really excited, start to grow faster, this is where they're ultimately going to be. And so our goal is to make sure we always have enough capacity for that range. But I also wanted to show this yellow line, and that's that goal state. We like our environments to run at the goal state. We would like all of our environments to always hit them. Now, we add capacity in decent-sized chunks. That's why you see these steps. We think we're going to, you know, have smaller chunks in the future. And then we also have the red line. That's obviously where things get really bad, things run out. So we really try to keep things at that yellow line. And as a result, in SharePoint Online, we're adding servers all the time. We're constantly adding new SQL servers, new front ends. And it's all about keeping ourselves right at that goal state. And then we keep that hardware so that if this environment actually starts to slow down and another environment starts to pick up, we have that hardware available to us to add. All right, this is a storage talk, so I have to dig in a little bit. Also, my team does all this work, so I'm excited about it. Fort Knox was talked about today. This is our move to really increase the size and scale of what we can do. And since we were going, you know, under the hood of SharePoint, we thought this was a great opportunity for us to really increase our security story as well. So the basic concept here is our databases are growing really, really fast. You know, Jeff talked about the scale. Things are really exploding, and those challenges that we talked about, they just get worse as the rate of growth for databases increases. So we looked inside of our databases, and we said, hey, there's a little bit of metadata and a whole lot of documents. You know, we turned on versioning in SharePoint Online by default. We started increasing the number of days in the recycle bin. We also just got a lot more users bringing data into the service, and we said, wow, we just have a lot of documents. And it turns out that Microsoft has this great, large-scale, boundless cloud storage platform. Azure has a storage system that's done some very innovative things. And we said, hey, let's take all of those documents and let's get them into Azure. And that'll leave us with these small databases that we know how to reason over. We can really optimize our operations for those small databases. And we can leverage the very economical storage opportunity that Azure provides us. So this is where those numbers you saw today come from, 1 terabyte site collections, infinite total storage. It's by leveraging these blobs being put into the Azure storage system that we're able to offer this here today. So what I just described probably sounds a lot like remote blob storage to a bunch of folks. Is there anyone who uses remote blob storage here? Okay, a couple. So I want to hit on a little bit. They are very, very similar. There are some key differences with what we've done with Fort Knox, both from a security level, but also just from how the storage works that enables us to have things like 1 terabyte site collections, which if you run RBS today, you know you can't go past the normal limits that we have for databases, even if blobs are taken out. And the key difference here, we can see if we just do a quick file request scenario. So if I request a file, I hit a SharePoint front end, and that's going to go to the Condon database and ultimately SQL. And SQL, through its provider, is going to request that file from whatever your ultimate store is. And that's going to return it to SQL, and it's going to give it back to SharePoint in a way that effectively SharePoint didn't know if that file was in SQL or was stored in some other system behind it. So it sort of hides that from SharePoint, and that load ends up being put on the SQL box instead. It's going to pass it back to the users, and there's a lot of things that they had to build into this platform because it's a generic platform built for SQL and built for things other than just SharePoint. And so there are elements here that we really didn't feel great about in SharePoint Online, things like the inability to do fine-grained permissions control, some of the stuff that we wanted to do with encryption. But also, it puts a lot of load on SQL, which actually is important in terms of being able to handle that metadata and be able to provide that really quick speed that we need, especially if we wanted to grow the content size. So when you go through Fort Knox, you're still going to SQL to find out where that file lives, but SharePoint is going directly to the store for that information and providing it directly through SharePoint back to the user. And so ultimately the result here is that we can leave that SQL I/O to SQL, allowing it to scale up those databases for other activity, but also let us really do some of the more interesting things that we wanted to do. We'll talk about that here in a second. I want to make one other clarification for folks who aren't super familiar with our shredded storage and how those things work. Before I talk a little bit about the security model, but when you save a document into SharePoint, it gets shredded into a bunch of different pieces. And so here I took a Word doc and I saved it, and SharePoint's going to end up with 3 blobs in this case. If it's all text, they're probably the same size. If it's a mix of images, text, it's going to be some unpredictable, I'm sure the code can do it, but I can't tell you, some set of blobs. But when you save something, you're not editing the existing blob, you're creating new blobs. And so if you notice, these are different versions of that same document. The first document had ABC, but when I saved a change to blob C, I end up with a new document that has D through G instead. And that continues as the life of the document continues. Every change results in just a new blob. And so I didn't actually resave A and B every single time. I have one copy of A, one copy of B, etc. But I can reconstruct any version of that document from those elements. So this is important when we look at how we actually encrypted these elements and did them at scale. So when you save your file in SharePoint Online, the Fort Knox system will actually encrypt each and every single one of those shreds with its own unique key. So every single shred has its own uniquely generated key. We also have this Azure backend system. It's a bunch of containers. They have their own security model. Each and every single one of those containers is unique and separated. And we sort of have an infinite supply of these containers. We can keep generating them as we need them. This is where that infinite scale of Azure comes from. And then the third element of Fort Knox is this key store. There's a key store per environment, think farm. And it's a place that we can watch very, very closely. There's a security talk, unfortunately, going on right now But Ben Canning's giving a talk on sort of how we secure these elements. You can watch it when the videos come out online. But we spent a lot of time ensuring that this thing is encrypted, it's secure, that no one has standing access to this. But inside of the key store, we actually store the keys for those Azure environments. And there's not one key. I have four keys here on the screen because I want to make sure everyone understands. There's no master key. There's no single key that I can go get access to every single one of these. I need all of the keys to each of those containers that I need access to. And this is important because when I save those documents into Azure, we're not putting them in line in a single location. We're actually spreading them across a series of those containers. So we're shredding that file, and we're encrypting each of those individual shreds, and then we're spreading those shreds out across multiple individual, uniquely locked containers. We also have to do something with the keys. So we have this other key, our encryption key. It's a master for the environment, and that's what we're going to use to actually encrypt those keys to the document themselves and store that into the ContentDB. So fundamentally, what we have is a ContentDB that knows where my document shreds are, and it has the keys to read them, even if it also needs the master key to be able to use them. I have this Azure environment, which has a massive number of shreds spread out effectively randomly across a massive number of servers and machines. No ability to access them individually, and no ability for them to reconstruct any document. And then we have the key store, which has these master keys, but doesn't actually know where anything is. It doesn't actually have access to each of those items. So what this enables us to do is to say, well, if something comes after the ContentDB, they don't actually have access to any of the containers that hold those blobs. Similarly, if something comes after those Azure containers, they don't actually have any of the keys to access them. They don't know how to reconstruct any of those shreds. They're all uniquely encrypted. And even if they come after the key store, well, the key store doesn't know where anything is. And you can imagine, you know, if you had a key to these giant vaults with shredded paper, you'd be a little overwhelmed at the amount of stuff you'd have to do. This is 256-bit encryption. You'd have to spend a lot of time trying to decrypt all of those shreds. And on top of that, we refresh those keys every day. So every one of those keys is uniquely generated on a daily basis. So we feel good about this story. We feel that it provides a new level of security at the same time as providing the scale that a RBS-type situation provides. But there's this one extra element, which is Windows Azure Storage. This is a cost talk. And so where I've been going this whole time is to talk about how we got this stuff into Azure and securely. Because Azure actually provides us a not just scale, but actually great reliability and at a great cost. And they do this with this concept called erasure coding. But first I want to say that Azure is an append-only data store. So as you add files to Azure, they're just adding new content. They're not going back and editing. It's very much in line with that blob story where you're adding new blobs all the time. They also offer local and geo replication. Local is within the same set of buildings, so think some number of buildings in a city. They're all close together, 20, 30, 50 miles apart. And then geo is going to be across sort of fault domains. So two different locations, they're going to be farther apart. They're within the same geography. These are not U.S. to EMEA. Your data never gets shared if you're in the U.S. region to EMEA or vice versa. But within the U.S., for example, you have U.S. West, U.S. East, and those can actually replicate data back and forth. Within the local replication, the traditional model here is three copies. So you want to have three copies to ensure that you never lose anything you put into Azure. But using erasure coding, they can actually get that down. So what is erasure coding? We're just going to do a high-level example. Say I have these two variables I want to save. I have A equals 2 and B equals 3. Traditional replication says the way to make sure you don't lose those is you just copy them. I lose one, I have a backup. Now, erasure coding instead says create some parity bit, this third item, which would allow you to reconstruct either of those values if one of them is lost. So in our example, if we lose A, then in traditional replication, I just go read my other alternate store of A. But in erasure coding, I have to do a little bit of work. I have to figure out what A was. But I can do that because I know that A plus B is 5 and B is 3. So a little bit of math tells me, hey, I still know what this is. But what's interesting about it is as you add additional parity bits and do a little bit more complicated sets, you actually can increase the number of replicas you ultimately have without actually increasing your cost. And so Azure has this model. There's a great video online. If you just search for erasure coding Azure, you'll see it. It's also in the appendix in the deck. But they use this model, 12 plus 4. It enables them to get the equivalent of 4 local copies. So they can handle up to 4 failures locally before you actually lose anything. And they only have to store 1.33 copies of that file. And so as you can imagine, this all comes back to that fundamental cost and how we can drop our cost significantly, offer large-scale storage without having to charge a significant amount. So I spent a lot of time talking about blobs. Let's switch gears a little bit and talk about SQL. This is one of my other favorite things that we're doing. So we mentioned things are growing fast. It's very hard to deal with. Every single time we do that, we end up having to do read-only time for users. And that's really painful. It's really painful for users. It's painful for us. We really don't like to do it. So they're inevitable, but painful. So we had to come up with an alternate solution. So we've built this new feature. We call it DB Mitosis. We are running this today against our own internal, the Microsoft tenant, for example. And very, very soon, we will start rolling this out into production as we really get it perfected. We're dealing with customer data. We're dealing with some low-level operations. So it's going to take us a little bit of time to get this out into production. But this is going to be a big win feature. So this ultimately allows us to do that database split operation in a matter of seconds. So DB splits today can take as long as 4 hours. It depends on the size of the database and the complexity of the data structures that the sites within them have. We can do this now in a couple of seconds. And so let's talk about what that looks like. So the basic model here is I have a database, and I need to split that database into two pieces. So the first thing I do is I create a copy of that database. So I can do that, back up the database in any moment in time. I can restore it. Now I just have a slightly out-of-date copy of that database. Now if I establish log shipping, I'm going to have a slightly less out-of-date copy of that database. And I'm going to keep that thing really close together. So this means that when I ultimately do mark that database read-only, and like I said, it's a couple of seconds of read-only time. I do have to mark it read-only, but it's going to be super short. Most users won't even notice. When I do ultimately mark that database read-only, I just have a couple of seconds for that second database to catch up. These are two servers. They're close by. I'm not talking about a true disaster recovery scenario. These are same data center. Now what we can do is the actual mitosis operation, and this is the new functionality that we've built. What we do is we break log shipping. So stop trying to tie those two together. They're two exact copies of each other. But what I'm going to do is I'm going to reach into the first database, and I'm going to tell it, hey, you own these sites. And then I'm going to reach into that second database, and I'm going to say, hey, you own the other half of these sites. So effectively, I'm going to tell the database, hey, we've split you. Even though they still have all the content in them still, I'm going to tell them that they are only responsible now for half of the information. And at that moment in time, when users access those databases, they're going to be routed to the database that is now the primary location for their data. At that same time, I'm going to flag those other sites to be deleted. So these are all ConfigDB level operations. I can tell SharePoint, hey, come back later, clean these up. You don't have to do it right now, but come back later and clean these up. And so all I've done here is a quick little configuration change to tell the sites, hey, you own something different, and you need to clean up some stuff. And that's it. Now I can let users go to work. They're going to be talking to the right database. They're going to be using the right things. I didn't have to actually move content while users were waiting. And over time, we will clean up those orphaned sites. We will eventually get rid of them. And in the end, I'm going to end up with two distinct databases. So I've effectively done a split, but I've managed to do that in seconds, which means I can do it at regular times when I need to, as the databases are growing, and not have to deal with these large scheduled downtimes, not impact users, be it even if it's in the evening. Last item on SQL. The other element we've had, and just sort of a couple of tips from things we've learned from running SharePoint Online and dealing with this scale of managing so many SQLs. There's a lot of aspects to running our service. How do we keep those SQLs available? How do you ensure that you know which SQLs are full and need to be rebalanced? Dealing with I/O, blocking, all these investigations. And we've had to spend a lot of time tooling just for them. We've actually had to really rethink what we consider monitoring of SharePoint and really make it SharePoint Online aware. So a good example of this is mirroring. We have had to do a lot of work on sort of our auto-heal concept for mirroring. Mirroring can be a little finicky, and so you need to be paying attention. You need to monitor it all the time. But when we do operations, DBSplit is another great example of this. When we do DBSplit, we end up changing some settings on mirroring while we're doing the operation. And the out-of-the-box SharePoint SCOM pack for SharePoint 2013, oh man, I thought it was a crisis. Started waking people up. Bad things are happening. Well, we were doing this on purpose. So we had to go through and actually retool a bunch of the 2013 product to understand these operations that we were doing, to be a little bit more aware of them. We also, in SharePoint Online, have this concept of a service fabric, this thing that manages all of these environments. And that thing thinks it understands SQL mirroring as well. And so we also had to write a bunch of tooling to keep sort of all these different things. You've got SharePoint, which thinks it knows which database is primary, which is the secondary. We have our service fabric, our grid manager, and then you also have SQL, which actually knows which one is the primary, which one is secondary. So we had to spend a lot of time figuring out how to keep those things in sync, keep them running together. And just another great example of this is our SQL patching. So we had a bunch of scripts for patching, and great, it's super easy to patch a server. You take it down, you apply the patches, you put it back up. But if you run like we do in SharePoint Online, where you stripe your databases, you're going to actually incur some problems. And so we had to, again, we had to retool sort of these common scripts that we might have been able to borrow from other teams or from other products. We had to actually say, hey, these really need to be SQL aware. They need to understand what's going on. And as we've invested in this, we've actually found a massive improvement in terms of the number of missed minutes. This is in terms of our SLA. We have had a great set of improvements over the last 6 months just by investing in these sort of low-level SQL monitoring, SQL tooling operations. All right, we spent a lot of time talking about SharePoint Online. We're going to talk a little bit about on-prem. So I'm going to start with this table, and it's a little low-level, and I don't mean to jump right into this level, but I wanted to show this example. This is an actual hard drive configuration that we have used in SharePoint Online. This is when blobs were inline, so no Fort Knox in this situation. And you'll see it's a pretty beefy SQL server. This is quite massive. We're using 900 gig drives, and these are 10K RPM, which is sort of the minimum I would recommend for someone trying to run the SQL workload for SharePoint. So pretty big machine. And I want to call out here at the bottom these 24 900 gig drives. We bought these large drive bays, put a lot of drives into them, because we really wanted to be able to provide the performance that comes with striping those disks. So we used RAID, we wanted to stripe them, but we also wanted the reliability, and so we actually did RAID 10. So we have effectively 12 striped disks mirrored, which we think gave us the right balance, the number of disks we really thought we needed to provide the performance that we thought was important. So when I work back and say, okay, great, let's talk about what this means for on-prem, I ran into a little bit of a challenge. So I said, great, let's do this 900 gig drive. I went into Amazon. I picked one a little bit at random. I'm sure if you price shop, you'll find something a little bit better. But this is a $318 drive. and it's roughly in the range of cost that you'll see for something of this performance. And so if I want to buy that server, 24 disks for data, I need 8 disks for the logs and the OS that are required to run a 24-disk data drive. I'm really only providing 9.5 usable terabytes to my users. So I just bought this hefty machine, and in the end, that machine is providing my users with 9.5 usable terabytes. And so if I think about the cost for that server, just disk, so I didn't buy any RAM, I didn't buy a processor, I haven't done any power, I'm looking at over $10,000 for a pretty beefy SQL server. And so when I wanted to do this for Microsoft, I said, all right, let's talk about that 40,000 synchronizing users. Those are the people providing majority of my content. I'm going to need more than 500 servers to provide them a service. And if I just provide HA, no disaster recovery, I'm looking at $88.24 a user in just disk. Now, you don't have to provide 25 gigabytes. You can control your cost by changing the scale of your offering, by changing how you roll things out. But if I just wanted to get those users out onto our service as fast as possible, I'm looking at some pretty initial costs, pretty high initial costs. If you want to add disaster recovery, you're over $16. Once you start thinking about power and people and everything else, I think sort of your floor here is around $30. It really starts to add up. So I'm not a sales guy, I'm not going to get too preachy, but I do have to call out the offering they mentioned today. $5 per user, 25 gigs each, if you come and use the OneDrive for Business standalone offering in SharePoint Online. You get to take advantage of all those investments we talked about, and you can expand your footprint today. So it's an option. I just want to call it out since you're here. There's a talk Wednesday morning at 9 a.m. I believe it is 363. Zeralina from the SharePoint organization, she's going to basically talk about if you want to integrate this OneDrive for Business experience into your existing footprint, so just expanding your footprint with this. She's going to go through sort of the onboarding techniques, what you can do. It's a great way to really control your cost and still offer that large scale. If I did not convince you, then you're still going to be on-prem. And so it's important that you fundamentally, you know, if you take anything away from today, it's really important you understand your business. How are your users going to use this? How are they going to onboard? Are they really going to use the 25 gigs if you give it to them? Or is there going to be a different number that's more important to your organization? What level of availability do you need to provide? Can you do downtime for your upgrades and for your database operations? Or do you need to run a 24/7 service? All of those things will come back to the cost and how much you actually need to spend. You can, I won't say cut corners, but you can lower the cost from what we discussed by really cutting back on some of those things. Also, if you're big enough, you can use remote blob storage. And I wanted to talk about RBS a little bit because I want to make sure we're clear on sort of when RBS applies and when it doesn't. Fundamentally, remote blob storage makes the most sense when you have a lot of files. They're relatively large, so not, you know, 1K text files, but relatively large. And they mostly fit into a category of write once, read rarely. And this can fit a number of user patterns, but I like to use the My Documents folder as a good example of this. This is what we see a lot of people use with OneDrive for Business. They set up their My Docs to use OneDrive for Business. It syncs to their devices. It's available everywhere. But fundamentally, people have a small set of documents that they're actively working on. And that small set of documents is constantly shifting to new documents as they're continuing to progress and do their work. And so you end up with this large set of files that rarely are used. You need to have them available. You need to expose them so that they can use them when they need them. But ultimately, they're sort of dead weight on those servers, consuming that expensive SQL disk that's really all about high-speed activity for those files they really use. The other element I want to call out, and I'm going to read this to make sure I get it right, your SQL storage costs need to be higher than the cumulative hardware and operational cost of running this additional system. So you're going to build out a second system. It's going to take knowledge. It's going to take a lot of work. You're going to learn new things. You're going to have maybe new systems. If you can run your entire company on 2 or 3 SQL servers, it might not be worth adding a whole new system to your environment. But if you're, you know, the Microsoft example, if you're going to set up 500 servers to handle the size of your business, then you might actually really benefit from using an RBS system. There are lots of RBS providers out there. I'm going to just briefly mention one. This is a Microsoft solution, Store Simple. And what I like about it, and the reason I bring it up, is it ties in really well with the conversation today, because it leverages both the RBS technology that's available in 2013, as well as the infinite scale of the cloud to really provide massive scale opportunity with an on-premises deployment. So basic idea with Store Simple, it's an appliance. It has a SSD tier, and that's for that really highly used material, the stuff that's very active. It also has the SaaS tier. It's local, it's part of the appliance, and that's where the rest of your stuff goes. But as that fills up, once that hits a certain threshold, it will actually start to send very cold documents, the stuff that nobody's actually looking at on a regular basis anymore, out to Azure. So taking advantage of that Azure cloud storage we talked about, it's offering that sort of infinite scale promise, always a place for you to put your documents somewhere in the cloud. This also allows them to do some cool things about disaster recovery. Since they know how to read from those cloud instances, they can put your backups in the cloud, and if your primary data center fails, they can actually get you going really quickly by reading from the Azure locations. They're fortunate enough to have someone from the Store Simple team come here, so if you have some questions afterwards about Store Simple, Paresh is up front and can help answer any questions on that. So I want to summarize with a couple of key points. I said it enough times, I'm sure you're sick of me saying it by now. You have to know your organization, you have to know how you're going to grow, how much resources you really need. You need to understand the true cost of the storage, of actually building out an environment to scale, to compete with something like a SkyDrive, to get your users off of the public SkyDrive and get them into your system. You need to be ready for the growth pattern. The growth pattern in OneDrive for Business in particular is extremely quick and very organic. Folks get a shared file and, hey, this is cool, and they set up file sync, and next thing you know, you're getting, you're increasing your number of files significantly. And then finally, just ultimately, we talked about 3 different solutions. We talked about running things in line in SQL, RBS, and putting things into OneDrive for Business in SharePoint Online. Find the solution that meets your needs, fits your business requirements, and works best for you. So with that, please fill out your evaluations. I really will read every comment you put. So if there was something you liked, please tell me. If there's something you didn't like, please tell me. I appreciate your feedback and taking the time to do that. And then finally, we just have a little bit of time for questions before I think you guys have Club SBC tonight. So any questions? So the question was, for Fort Knox, where are the accounts, the credentials stored for the system? So we are, this is the benefit of getting to do things in the cloud first. We're still sort of deciding how things will eventually look for that particular element when we get this stuff into the sort of the SharePoint bits that ship. The current design has them living in the ConfigDB using the encrypted store that's part of the configuration. Obviously, depending on how much we want that to scale per environment, we may look at using the secure store or something else. So not really sure at the moment, but there's definitely lots of options for it. But it is a farm-level configuration. Any other questions? Yes. So the question was, do we have a OneDrive for Business for team sites? At the moment, you know, that's one of the key additional features that you get when you sign up for either a P or E, sort of the enterprise or small business SKU services. So at the moment, yeah, OneDrive for Business is really focused on individuals and their storage. They can do sharing, you know, cross-organizational sharing from those locations. But at the moment, the team site business is really part of those other SKUs. So we don't have a plan for that at the moment. So the question was what's the transactional cost of the transactional consequence of Fort Knox and what it does? And I'm assuming the tie-in here is the security operations, not the general. Yeah. Yes, you know, and this is something that we're watching, and this will influence how big those shreds, how small or big we really try to aim those shreds to be. So yes, if documents over time, and documents are growing in size over time, and so as documents get very large, if a particular document gets extremely huge and has many, many shreds across many different components, you can end up with a little bit of overhead. We will look at how that actually happens, and we're going to optimize our algorithms to decide how spread out things should actually be, whether to keep things a little constrained. We are not sure, though, that an individual document will necessarily suffer from that, except in the most extreme of cases. Majority of documents do have a limited lifespan. You really don't actually see documents that live forever. There are rare cases, you know, any sort of percentile chart. But for the most part, documents end up having a very short lifespan. We find that if you touch a document, if you haven't touched a document in 30 days, then very likely you won't ever touch that document again. So those sorts of patterns will influence what we ultimately do. But in terms of just normal documents on a regular basis, we actually don't see very much overhead in doing all these additional operations. The performance characteristics are really on par with what we see today. Getting it out of SQL, avoiding that extra hop, actually lets us balance it out. So it's not necessarily a new perf win because we're doing a little bit more work, but we're adding all of that security without actually incurring much cost. Anyone else? Well, if that's it, I'm here for a few more minutes. Otherwise, thank you for coming. And again, fill out your session evals.